Hello, you are now listening to the Modum Podcast, where we deconstruct, examine, and discuss deeply technical data networking and information technology topics. Sit back and relax while we fire up Dial D and the 9600 baud modem and connect to the Wildcat BBS.
Hello, welcome to another episode of the Modum Podcast or the Modum Show or Modum or whatever you want to call it. Today, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to go deep on the tech, but we're also going to talk about an event that the four of us, who I'll introduce shortly here, participated in just recently. It was the inaugural Service Provider Network Field Day for service providers. It was very interesting, and there was a common theme here. But before we get into that theme, I want to introduce everybody, and I'm going to go around the room, and I'm going to start with Vince. Why don't you introduce yourself?
Vince Shuley, I'm a consulting network architect in the service provider space. Work on the enterprise a little as well. You can find me on Twitter at Shuley22 or blogging at stubarea51.net.
All right. And Kevin.
Yeah, my name's Kevin Myers. I'm a senior network architect at IP Architects, which is a consulting company that I founded. And like Vince said, he and I work together building ISPs pretty much every day all around the world. And a little bit of enterprise and data center thrown in there. You can find me on at stubarea51 on Twitter and also at stubarea51.net blocking.
All right. And Chris.
Hey, Chris Cummings, at CrankyNetMan on Twitter, co-host here, and I have a blog, /64.tech, that's the word slash, the number 64, really comes out well over the air. Glad to have Vince on. I think Vince is new. You've never been on Modum, have you, Vince?
No, I have not. This is my second podcast, so
first glad timer. To be here. Not glad to have Kevin on, for the record. No, we've had him plenty, and that's
pretty tired. Standard. Yeah,
just say, enough. Vince. Welcome to Thunderdome.
Two routes enter, one route leaves.
Yes.
One route goes to the rib. All right. Well, okay. So for those that don't know, service provider are, you know, we've been talking about them here for quite some time, but in the network field day realm, which is a, you know, an event that happens multiple times per year where vendors come in and you know, they let folks like us take a deep dive into their technology. There hasn't been one that's been specifically focused on service providers. And there's been a few of us that have kind of been harping on that for a little while. So they finally did it. And I got to say, it was, you know, for the first time going through something, I was really quite happy with the level of turnout and the technical detail and the things that we talked about. I don't know how you guys felt about it, but I'm guessing it's pretty similar.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that it was really cool to get a actually service provider oriented field day, because, you know, a lot of times network field day, which is an awesome event, a lot of times it focuses on enterprise tech because that's where a lot of folks sit and a lot of folks work every day. But then there's this weirdo WAN folks that are kind of over here in the service provider field. And, you know, sometimes we want to dive really deep into all the bizarre stuff we do in optical and, you know, that scary MPLS thing. And it was pretty fun to actually get to dive into how the cloud that's on everybody's network diagram works. I think that's how Tom kind of put it when he introduced the event. He's like, today we're going to talk about the cloud that sits on all your diagrams. I love that. It was a good event.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. You know, going through what the vendors presented to us, I don't want to necessarily focus on one particular thing. I want to talk about a theme that was very clear. And I'm suddenly having visions of Christmas Story because it's, you know, Christmas season right now, holiday season. I want you to write a theme.
Christmas Story is very near and dear to my heart growing up in Northwestern Indiana. That's like the stuff of legends.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, that's why Kevin wasn't allowed to use MPLS. He was gonna blow his eye out or shoot his eye out with MPLS. Yeah.
He's gonna shoot my IP out.
Shoot his IP out. Blow the routes out. No. Anyway, so to me, the theme here was, and this is common in service provider space for those that don't operate in that world regularly, underlays and overlays are kind of the bread and butter of of a typical carrier and or anyone working in the carrier space, be it regional or, you know, local or national or international, it's all overlays and underlays. And we talked a lot about that with varying levels of detail and varying pieces of technology to sort of accomplish these goals. Did you guys see that same theme?
I would say yes. Yeah. It definitely seemed like a lot of folks were talking about a few technologies stuck out a lot. Segment routing and all of its various flavors, SRv6, SRMPLS, SRISIS. There was definitely a lot of talk about like the actual guts of how to get things from A to B. And then a ton of talk about how to actually carry services over the top of all that. So, okay, you've built out this thing that gets things from one place to another. Well, how do you carry different things actually and package them up to go over that network? And to me, the theme was definitely EVPN big time, which was really nice and refreshing to hear.
Yeah, and you know, I'll go off that, right? When we build all of our service provider networks and going back to what Nick said earlier, you don't think about this a lot in the enterprise space until EVPN, VXLAN came in the data center, but you're building an underlay. You're going to use some flavor of, you know, OSPF, ISIS, and LDP probably today. But if you're building anything new or migrating, you're moving to segment routing, you're looking at segment routing or one of its flavors, you're probably looking at ISIS. And then you're looking at a way to simplify all the various overlay technologies that we run. I mean, just the list is too long. You have VPN, V4, VPLS, LDP signaled VPLS, BGP signaled VPLS, VPN V6, you go on all day for it. And all of those have different protocols that you have to manage.
And I think another thing that I saw, and I saw the same thing that you guys did about, overlay and underlay, segment routing, EVPN. I mean, that was pervasive in pretty much everything. And I think part of it, too, was also a push for simplification so that we can work towards automation, which service providers have embraced automation of provisioning for a long time. And I feel like the world that we're entering now that segment routing and EVPN provides this layup for is I want to simplify my control and data plane so that I can start bringing automation to operations and not that we haven't had it before, but it's when you have so much complexity and you're trying to deal with managing state operationally and automation, which to be fair is not my thing. I'm a route switch guy. I'm not an automation guy, but I sit around a lot of smart automation people and I look at what they look for. And I think, you know, simplifying the design and the build of the network so that you can turn it over to automation more cleanly is what everybody seems to be after. And so that's one of the end games that I saw of getting to segment routing and building an EVPN and these overlay-underlay architectures that everybody is racing towards is we want to be able to turn the network operation over to automation.
Oh, totally agree. And I think that was something that one of the presenters pointed out was, you know, you have even in an enterprise deployment of EVPN VXLAN, you have 70 different ways to do it and everybody wants it done their exact different way and everybody's got their own flavor of everything. And I think that one thing I've seen in the various automation efforts I've undertaken, it's all about simplifying what services you offer and, you know, at the bare minimum, at least categorizing and defining what services you offer. And once you do that, you'll typically find it's okay. Well, these have a ton of overlap and it's kind of like Steve Jobs did back in the early Apple days. Well, when he came back to Apple, right, they had all the clones and of the Mac computers and they had just all these different models and they had the Newton and all these weird things. And he kind of went in and just kind of killed all that off and had a very simple product offering. And when you do automation, it's the same thing. Like it can kind of be a hard sell at first to be like, well, we need to offer less because immediately people go, no, we want to offer everything. But if you want to offer a reliable service that is, easier to scale at lower cost, you kind of need to trim down a lot of the, you know, if you have 5 customers that have that one really bespoke config out of your 10,000, is that really worth the effort that it takes to maintain that?
So I think it's also important to point out, like in the service provider space, simplification and automation of things has been around for a very long time in the CPE management world. Like there's TRO69, there's all these proprietary customer provisioning platforms. You don't grow a service provider from hundreds to thousands to tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of subscribers without being able to manage their endpoints in a sane way. So your DOCSIS cable modem, your ONT from your fiber service, your DSL router, there's not a person that goes in and configures those by hand every time they push one out. Like there's a system that's automated all of that, and they're moving. And this is, again, simplification of services, right? There's three packages, right? You can get whatever these things are. They're not going to deviate from that, right? You want something different, you go to a business class service, and then you can say, I can have static IPs, but you can only have this exact thing, right? You can have, one or five, and that's it. And whatever V6 they provision you, if you're lucky. And so that's existed a long time, but like the overlay services, those haven't necessarily been centrally managed. In some cases they have, but that I see as a, it's something moving outward in, from a certain point of view. I mean,
Nick, I wanted to come back on something you just said there. You have a set service offering that you offer. Where I see people that start to get in trouble is they'll deliver whatever the customer asks for. And then that becomes something that's almost impossible to manage or automate because, there's so many different options there. So how do you balance the idea of I need to have what the customer offers or what the customer wants and deliver them something, and this is my product offering to get to the right answer?
And I'm going to sound like a Steve Jobs stan here, but he literally said, some people say like give customers what they want, but customers don't know what they want. I think he hearkened back to like Henry Ford when he said that whole quote, something along the lines of like, if you ask a customer what they want, they'd ask for a faster horse, not a car. And like, you have to do that if you want to actually scale something up. That's a great point.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's true. And I think that's a mistake that a lot of small service providers make, right? Because they're just trying to get revenue. Because building a service provider, like especially a consumer residential service provider, it's very hard to make money. It's very hard because infrastructure in the ground is really expensive, and residential customers want the most. They want to pay the least and they complain the loudest. So, that's something that happens a lot with small ISPs. But, getting back to the backbone carrier space, you have the similar thing where you can say, I'm going to offer this L3 VPN. I'm going to offer this pseudo wire, whatever it is. And how do I manage that? And what is that technology that it's running on? How can I simplify that? Because right now, that's really complicated, right? It's a whole suite of protocols that are needed to do these things. And I think there was one of the themes, and I could see Kevin getting itchy here. One of the themes was what, Kevin?
There were a lot of themes, but VPLS was certainly central to that, and navigating the change from VPLS into EVPN with its various L2 forwarding overlays. But one thing I do want to say though, Nick, is that you hit on a really important point that I don't want to lose sight of, and I think it directly relates to the complexity that we're talking about, is that we often use the word service provider very liberally, but you have very many different kinds of service providers. You've got, peering and transit providers, transport providers, data center providers that mostly sit in the data space. And then you have mobility and last mile providers, which branch out into, wireline and telco. And so they all have these different, variations that you go into. And what I often find is that the larger ISPs that are mostly focused on peering and transit and transport, it's a little easier for them to simplify because they're not worried about the last mile. Their vendor spread can be less, right? Because they're not, they're not worried about those last mile circuits. They're usually cross connects in a data center. And that's not true of all of them, but it is true of a lot of them. And so the way that they're built is, very different in the complexity set that they inherit versus if I'm going to go look at a telco, a last mile ISP, wireless ISP, FISP, whatever, where you do have all of that baggage that you've got to do is to get through that cloud that we draw and say, here's how I connect. But when you're down in the weeds, that's, you know, that's ROTMs and that's, you know, ONTs and OLTs. And so I think to your point about the complexity of it, that's the single biggest challenge I think you have in ISPs that are trying to serve different markets that are last mile, small business, residential, and then maybe they also have some government and, you know, and medium-sized business and big business in their service territory, because they do feel like they need to offer this spread of, you know, portfolio of services. Because if, you know, the, you know, city that's adjacent to you comes to you and says, hey, we want to peer with you, which you wouldn't really think is very common, but man, I can't tell you the number of cities that have their own ASN these days because they're peering into diverse providers. That was a big shock to me a few years back when we started seeing a lot of that. And so you're going to want to capture that revenue, and you figure out, okay, even though 80% of my revenue is, you know, is selling to homes and small businesses, I still want to figure out how to capture this. So to bring it back around to the complexity argument, I feel like you're basically faced with a few different sets of complexity to solve. You have last mile provider and what they're trying to do, which is, you know, be a bit of a Swiss Army knife to everybody in their service territory. And then you have the peering and transit and transport providers that are hyper focused on a smaller portfolio of services they sell that are almost exclusively B2B. And so I think that's where we saw a divergence in the conversation, because VPLS came up, which if you're a last mile provider, VPLS is all, you know, all day, every day, it's all over the place. If you're a peering and transit and transport provider, you know, you can make the shift into EVPN, you know, more easily, because again, you're not dealing with metro Ethernet equipment. You don't have 30 MEF boxes going out in the last mile that you've got to contend with in delivering that circuit. So that's where I see it is. There's just two different conversations to be had around how you do this and how you navigate simplifying the complexity of delivering those services by the type of ISP that you are.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to kind of shout out some of that like complexity that comes in that weird last mile space. I know, Kevin, one time you sent me a bunch of pictures of some CO you were in that was like, you know, in the basement, like asbestos everywhere, you know, like boilers everywhere. And it's just like, some of this is in really weird spots and this is like crammed into every weird corner. And we'll link this in the show notes.
John Osmond, an abandoned Mexican restaurant in the one, I know the data center you're talking about. It was a Cogent pop.
Yes.
And I won't say what city or where it was, but there was an abandoned Mexican restaurant in the basement. And there was also an elevator from like the 1920s that later got condemned because we had to lug a Juniper chassis. We had to lug a Juniper MX up a flight of stairs because the first time I went there, I was like, man, this place is kind of old. Like, you know, the only people that were tenants in the building, which was like a 30-story building, were the ISPs. Nobody else was in it. And when we rode the elevators and I saw the infrastructure, I was like, man, I'm surprised this is still in operation. And the next trip I took, the state that it was in with the state board that covers the elevators said these elevators are condemned until further inspection. I'm like, oh, that's great.
And that's the weird stuff you have to deal with. I mean, that's just like a tiny little glimpse into it. We'll also link to a post by one of our hosts, John Osmond, that he did recently about a data center in Albuquerque, where he talks about what's called the ramp room. And it's fantastic blog post. One of my favorite blog posts I think I've ever read. He just kind of goes into just the weird forgotten annals of time and weird corners that networks actually live in. And that is
a great
post. Oh, it's so good. Yeah. We'll link it for sure.
So my first Sonic gear was in the basement of a pizzeria. They'd built a wooden shelf around it and put this, you know, Fujitsu FLM gear in there, brought the fiber in, broke it out to me. And then we ran structured cabling to my office, which is where all the gear was. But we had to put plastic over the front of it because they didn't put a door. And there were so many bags of flour down there because they made all the dough and stuff. This is like a very well-known pizzeria where I live. And so there was flour dust on everything down there. So that's the kind of stuff that you deal with in the service provider world.
So I want to jump on this because I know Vince is dying to jump in. But before we get off this one tangent, that's why I use the word data center very liberally. And we talked about this yesterday, because when I talk with clients, a data center could literally be like one of the, you know, 10th largest data centers in the world that you have your gear in. It also for me has been the luggage room at a Holiday Inn in the US Southwest because that was the only place they could get the transit circuit to. And so they brokered a deal with the Holiday Inn in the place where they hold your bags, you know, when you're waiting to go to the airport, and they put a few racks back there. And so that was that we labeled it as the DC because we had some compute and storage and some racks there. And the Holiday Inn luggage room was the DC. So it's a very, you know, it's a very fluid concept in the provider space.
I was so glad to see, I think Cisco actually at the presentations at Network Field Day Service Provider, I think that they actually talked about the different tiers of data centers and how there's, you know, your global data centers, like you're talking about, you know, your Equinixes, your H5s, like your all those big players, right? And then you have maybe somebody not that. And like you have way different needs there. Like you're not throwing the 33U Cisco 8800 router that they released yesterday, they talked about yesterday. Like you're not throwing that in the back of the coat closet at the Hilton.
I don't know. You could hang a lot of coats on that. It's 33RU tall. I could put a lot of coats
room
on that.
It would thing. Be warm in the winter too.
Yeah.
I have a couple points to make here. I think that was a pretty good transition here, right? Because I asked this question to the guys at Cisco because of all those different tiers of data center and the different ways you can deliver. And when you start to look at the really large content providers, maybe if you're a service provider in your data center, you get one of their magic black caching boxes and you're just treating it like a PE. But if you're a large content provider, you probably have a more, you know, I hate to say it, enterprise-style data center where you're moving around packets within yourself and then transporting it out to that magic box that everybody gets content with, right? So I think we lose sight of a lot of those content providers are still a service provider, but they're focused on moving around big data, right, within their data center. So that's a much different feel than like a transit and peering or a last-mile data center. And then you know, Cisco had this again on the how do you deal with the complexity in the last mile or the migration of VXLAN to MPLS data planes. They were really the only people that came with an answer. And it sounded like they supported VPLS to EVPN seamless migration. And you know, the only other person I've seen that supports that is Nokia. If I had to guess now, Juniper might support it too. I'd have to go do some research, but I'm pretty interested in testing out that feature set on iOS XR because that can make a pretty easy way because plugging in a layer 2 circuit from EVPN into a layer 2 circuit from VPLS and just passing .1Q, I feel like you're asking for a loop there.
Yeah, having to physically stitch those two layer 2 domains together is really complex. And it's not a fun one. I think Arista had something not for layer 2, but for layer 3 as well. They were talking about moving from layer 3 VPN to EVPN. But yeah, it's definitely seems like those transition mechanisms are really necessary because, yes, moving to just BGP and just another address family in BGP, which is what you gain with EVPN, is definitely more simple. But I think another theme that I saw was, like you mentioned, it's we have brownfield networks. We don't have greenfield networks very often in the service provider space, and we have to support a ton of stuff. And like when you're talking about these, you know, weird ramp rooms and weird Mexican restaurant data centers, you can't just go and replace the gear there every 3 years like you can in your data center. And it's not just, you know, a nice cloth style fabric, you know, two stage or whatever. Like it's not that simple and clean. Service provider networks are really dirty. And so you gotta both physically sometimes and logically, just because they grow organically. You have acquisitions, you have old technology, just all sorts of crazy things like that.
And the acquisitions is a huge thing right now. Like that's, I mean, Vince and I are on like, I mean, what we have like 5 or 6 different, you know, ISPs we're working for. They're doing heavy mergers and acquisitions. So, you know, when you look at the financials of those, which we often forget about in the technical space, we're like, oh, you just, you know, you could just do this or you have to do this and it has to be this. And then you go look at an ISP that got a bunch of private equity money to go acquire all these other ISPs. Even if you had the money to go replace all the gear, you're not going to have the boots on the ground to just go rip everything out of every ISP you've acquired and just go redo that. And so I think, and I've seen, you know, we looked at, you know, I know we talked to Arista and they were still working on their migration strategy for VPLS to EVPN. And I've seen this in other vendors at other NFDs that are in this space. You know, I've seen it in the disaggregated space as well, where everybody kind of banked on EVPN getting so hot and taking off so fast that they would never go build, you know, things like VPLS or build the migration strategies. And, you know, much like some of the other protocol migrations we've been through, things don't always take off as fast as you expect. And you're going into this phase migration and not a big bang. I mean, that's a recurring theme in network engineering, you know, phase migration versus big bang migration for decades.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that they did touch on, which we called out, was that they recognized, I think it was one of the Cisco presenters recognized, like, you've got this other, you know, you've got a legacy network out here that you have to deal with. And that's every service provider everywhere. You don't upgrade like you do in other environments. It's a rolling upgrade that usually starts on one side and moves to the other, or starts in the core and moves out. And it may take 3 to 4 years. And by the time you're done with that, you're already planning for the next round of those. So it's a constant state of transition within a service provider network. I mean, some of the equipment, like the optical gear that we talked about, you know, they talked about converging down into packet optical, which is a whole podcast in and of itself, which we should probably do. But the, you know, they talked about converging that down. But in most networks that are transport, you know, oriented, the mean time to replacement of your optical shelves is like a decade, right? You can replace transponder shelves and, you know, other things maybe every 5 to 7 years when you need faster feeds. But when you're ripping and replacing an entire optical plant, a DWDM plant across even a state, you're talking, you know, 10 years probably of lifespan on that equipment.
Yeah, that stuff's not cheap, nor is getting the talent or the skill to go get new optical shelves in and go splice all that in. I mean, that's, you know, trying to find the people to do that operationally and get that all done and get the money to go, you know, with that. And I get it for a large, you know, for if you're a tier one, especially if you're a mobility provider and you're just throwing out towers, you know, all day long because of like 5G, you know, I totally get the converged optical, but I'm not 100% sold on the converged optical for every ISP, because a lot of ISPs aren't trying to make, they're not trying to make their fiber multi-tenant. We had this conversation with an ISP because they were like, do I need ROADMs? I was like, are you trying to sell waves? And how much fiber do you have? And they were like, I don't need to sell waves. I just need enough for my transport. And I was like, okay, well then maybe you should put that money into either laying more fiber or getting, you know, or beefing up the network gear that you're putting in and not going out and buying ROADMs if you're not going to have complex paths, or you're not going to be selling waves as a service. And pocket that money and use it somewhere else. So not saying it's a bad solution. I think it's a great, technically, I think it's an awesome solution. But financially, and looking at the economics of ISPs, I don't know that it works for
every ISP. Well, a lot of ISPs have moved away from two things. One, that nobody does dark fiber. No, they don't. They want to get away from that because then you light up your own optical gear and do whatever you want on those pairs. And even I'm seeing more and more, they don't want to sell waves either. They want to sell you a managed service, which is X bandwidth, you know, with an SLA and a, you know, a fast reroute path. And that's where these overlays are coming into play, because they allow for so much more flexibility when you can say, well, I can sell you, you don't have to buy a full 10 gig wave or a full 100 gig wave. We'll sell you 4 gigabits per second, this managed service over a TILFA FR path, you know, and guarantee you bandwidth as long as it's on the primary. You know, and now I'm getting money for an SLA and a service, and I can oversell that if I need to, you know, or I can however I want to do it. Right. It allows for significantly more flexibility when you're implementing something with, like, say, SRTE paths, like we talked quite a bit about yesterday.
Yeah, I thought a lot of the packet optical stuff, or they called it routed optical, was, I guess, Cisco's branding of it. But I found that pretty interesting. I'm a bit dubious of how well it would work in a, like, a real long haul context. I think it makes a lot more sense in the metro. But another thing that I heard that kind of was intriguing to me was, you know, okay, well, you lose OTN, right? And I guess to maybe zoom out for folks who aren't used to that, because I sure wasn't until, you know, a year or so ago. OTN, you know, optical transport networking, is kind of like Sonnet, but more recent. That's like the very simple term. And flame me, people on Twitter at CrankyNetMan. Just tell me how you hate me. But you know, more or less, that's what it is, right? And so you have a lot of flexibility you gain with that. One big thing that I've seen is you'll have transponders that are capable of going over multiple. Basically, using OTN, you can, let's say you can only close, one wave at like 400 gigabits per second. That's a bad example. Let's say you can only close one wave at 200 gigabits per second and another wave at 600 gigabits per second. But you want to actually break that out to 2 400 gigs. Well, you have 800 gigabits total there, but you want to break it out to 2 400 gig optics. How do you do that? If you don't have OTN, you can't really do that. And that's where OTN provides a lot of flexibility. And I think in the long haul space where you have much tighter margins on your optical budget, things like that start to become a bit more important. So I don't know if I truly have bought into packet optical in the long haul space, but I think in the metro, it could make a lot of sense. But I mean, hey, in the metro, you also have really tight optical budgets. So what do I know? Because you have a lot of ROADMs. But it's really interesting to me, just this concept then that they talked about was, well, there are still cases where we want OTN, specifically in the context of POTS lines. And so we're actually talking about OTN over MPLS. And I'm just like, oh my God. Okay. So we're moving something around and we're just shuffling that problem around to different layers. And so part of me wonders like how valuable it is. I definitely think it's cool technology. And I love the idea of tunable pluggables that, you know, you can actually use on a per port basis. But you know, I think the big question that it comes down to me is, you know, can you get the launch power you need in those tunable pluggables in a QSFP DD form factor? That's still marketing at this point. If you can, I think that's pretty cool. Else, you're going to have to go to a CFP2 DCO, which is a much bigger form factor, much bulkier to be able to basically handle all that heat, power, and cooling and all that fun stuff, which now means your router density goes down, you know, significantly. So, you know, I wonder, like, maybe if you get rid of your transponder shelves, can you make up for that in router density? I don't know. But part of it also does sound kind of like, oh, we want to sell you bigger routers. We have a 33 RU router. Let's use it.
Well, let's talk about fate sharing. I mean, do I really want all my eggs in one basket? I mean, obviously, this is the whole, you know, what are my trade-offs? My trade-offs are increased complexity and, you know, in management of this separate optical layer, what I gain is the modularity that if there is a fundamental flaw in this tech, I have at least the ability to separate those two failure domains into, you know, something where they're not, you know, tied together. Because there is a major problem, then, you know, I'm, you know, it's all joined together. It's always been my big problem with collapsing too far, because that we're on this wave, right, in networking and I guess in IT in general, of, you know, collapsing and simplifying and then breaking things apart. And we just ride this wave year after year. But that's been my big challenge is, and not to get into the power conversation, because we could go on for hours about the power side of it. But like, that's my other question is that, again, this gets back to the difference between a last mile provider or if, you know, if somebody that's, you know, totally focused on mobility or, you know, whatever it is. You know, when you're looking at solving multiple problems, and then let's, you know, take ourselves outside of the context of North America, or we have, you know, up until recently had this assumption of stable power and a stable power grid, go into Latin America, go into Africa, where, you know, you have a lot of physical, you know, environmental and geopolitical challenges that you've got to deal with. And so it's hard to, you know, always put these solutions into there. There's a lot of times where a passive shelf for optical makes a lot of sense because you don't have the power, you know, or you don't have the budget or whatever it is, but you've still got to light that system. So I see value, like you guys said, I see the value of it in the metro networks. And I'll tell you the other place I see value in the converged optical is there's been some stuff published about, and I think it was Cisco that actually did it. So this makes sense about, like, Deutsche Telekom is a good example. They were talking about converting their network architecture towards data center to be leaf spine, to where they were basically, because they were doing EVPN and they pushed the problem of making it very symmetrical in transport, where service providers are very asymmetrical in the way that their physical transport is designed, down to the optical layer. So exactly what you were describing, Chris, where you were like, hey, I have 200 gig and I have 600 gig, but I need to make it look like 400 gig on each side. And so if I want to run a leaf spine architecture out of a CO into the last mile and abstract that difference down to layer one and layer zero, then with a converged optical, I could more easily do that. And then I throw EVPN on top. And as far as, you know, all of my COs just look like leaves, right? In that kind of an architecture. So, and that was, Cisco highlighted that specifically to say, hey, we're doing leaf spine in Metro. It's not just in the data center. We're using this architecture in a Metro and pushing the complexity somewhere else. In this case, the optical layer. So I think in that context, converged optical makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And I think where it's hard is where you're pushing, like you're only running into those issues where, you know, you're like trying to milk every last gigahertz of, you know, spectrum out of your fiber when you're in the really, really, really high performance space. And I think that that's probably not where packet optical is suited for. It's more for, you know, I mean, like I could think of a radio tower, right? You need a router at a radio tower. You pop this bad boy there. You've got a, you know, two fiber paths in and out. Maybe you're on a ring or something like that. You don't have to have dedicated transponders. Like you probably cut half a rack of gear out just by doing that. And I do see the value.
This is a great example of the underlay piece that a lot of folks don't know exists. You know, the whole optical realm, like you said, Kevin, it's hard to find engineers that know it and work on it, you know, and it's one of those very fundamental pieces to networking in the, you know, internetworking, the internet in general, that, you know, it just kind of happily functions and 99.9% of even IT professionals don't have any idea that it's there or what it does or how it works. And it's a whole art form in and of itself. And it's very telco-ish in nature. So like a lot of the gear, you know, has, if you want to use this, it doesn't, a lot of it, you just, it's not meant to be run from the command line, right? They have a management platform that essentially automates all the stuff that's happening in TL1 underneath the covers. And for those that don't know what TL1 is, it's a command line language for managing telco gear. If you really are masochistic, go look up the command syntax. It's something.
A lot closer, like a lot of this optical stuff is a lot closer to electrical engineering than it is to networking. And I think that's why we have a lot of, there's like a big knowledge gap, I think, between folks who maybe do routing and folks who do optical. Like it's just,
they're different disciplines.
They're very different. The optical is very physics oriented, right? Because of the, you know, the nature of what it is, breaking wavelengths out and understanding the physics of dispersion and all of that stuff.
And that's something that needs to be, I think, taken into account when you're talking about converging these systems. Like if you have very distinct optical teams in your organizational structure, how does that work? Like if your optical people aren't allowed to log into your routers, now your routers are your transponders. How do you manage that? Like that's a huge organizational shift. It's not just a technology shift.
Yeah, that's a great point. Like what happens if, you know, the router gets tanked because, you know, somebody in the optical world is, you know, is making a change. And then the converse is true. I'm not going to throw the optical guys under the bus because they're in the basement of the OSI model. But like, you know, the same is true of the routing guys. The right, you know, we don't need this interface. I don't need this config. And, you know, suddenly you've got waves going down everywhere. Having been in that shared administrative space where you have different teams, like when I dabbled in enterprise for a while and I worked for a publicly traded company where we had huge teams and multiple teams had administrative responsibility for, you know, routers and switches and firewalls. And that did not always end well.
Yeah. You've definitely got the tribal factions when it comes to those disciplines, because I think, like you said, they're very, very different. And it's very hard to find optical people. Like if folks are thinking about, oh, it's difficult to find a high end network engineer that understands BGP and protocols or whatever, multiply that by 1,000. And that's what it's like to find an optical engineer that's really, really good. They're just few and far between because, like I said, the lifespan is 10 years and that knowledge gap, like you said, Kevin, is a huge deal. It's not something you can just learn in a couple of days, right? It's something that there's a lot of intuition involved with it. There's a lot of understanding of complex physics and things to really get it. And that's not something that is easily obtained or quickly obtained.
No, it's not. And it's something that we don't, you know, we don't spend a lot of, you know, most network engineers, they're, you know, their exposure to optical is normally, you know, plugging an SFP into a router or a switch and looking at light levels. And, you know, maybe you're, maybe you've dealt with bi dyes, maybe you've done a little DWDM on a passive shelf, but, you know, not gone much further than that. So getting into a ROTEM or some other kind of managed, you know, optical system is a is just, you know, like we've said before, they're very different worlds. So I don't know how those two come together. But I will say, you know, there's something that you touched on, Nick, that I wanted to throw out there to talk about as well, as we talked about the different kinds of underlays, is that another theme that we saw in SP1 is that, and this isn't a new thing for service providers, is that there's not just one underlay or one overlay. I mean, there are literally, you know, it's like, remember the movie Inception, where you're down like three levels of, you know, into the dreams. You know, it's the same with network engineering, and it's been that way for a long time. It's not uncommon to put MPLS on top of MPLS on top of MPLS, or, you know, stacking or interworking, you know, different layer two protocols together. So, you know, and I think it was DriveNets that had proposed this idea, and we kind of whacked away at it for a while to figure out exactly what the overlay underlay was that they were doing with commodity switches and a distributed chassis. But as we got to it, that it was a VXLAN underlay so that service providers could automate and orchestrate whatever, you know, routers, switches, services, whatever they want on top of it, it became clearer. And so now the thing that struck me and that we all talked about was, okay, so I'm going to go put MPLS on top of VXLAN. So VXLAN just gives me L2. And then I'm going to go put some other, you know, some routers on top of that. And they're going to run MPLS between themselves. And they might even hand off, you might even have another overlay above that, because, you know, you're just going to sandwich it like a 7-layer dip. So, you know, that was an interesting thing to talk about, because we don't talk about that enough, is that when we talk about overlays and underlays, it's often talked about in the singular context. And we don't talk about the tiers of overlays and underlays that have evolved as we've gone into the MPLS world.
I wanted to touch on the idea that you brought up of this disaggregated chassis, right? Because as you start to go there and look at it, I know Nick and Chris, you seem to like the chassis world. Kevin and I live much outside of...
I'm on the fence, Vince. different tools for different jobs. I'm on the fence there.
Outside of the chassis world. But when you start to look at like another... thing that we've touched on or skirted around a few times here is, as you get into some of these data centers or like the Cord project or like, you know, CO re-architected as a data center, and you have these leaf spines, what's to stop me from putting some leaves to aggregate the optical, put different leaves that aggregate the peering in transit, put different leaves for slow speed for lower port speeds to break all that out? And, you know, without automation, that becomes pretty management cumbersome. And that's where I kind of like this idea of the disaggregated chassis, where I can have, you know, a singular control plane that controls all of those different things, just like I would with line cards.
I've definitely seen networks that do that on the optical layer, where they just hand off an optical connection. They don't put any layer three. They backhaul all their layer two, layer three optically over protected rings back to, you know, regional locations, and they break it all out that way. So they've traded some of that complexity of layer two and three for spending a little bit more money on layer one, probably getting, you know, double the lifespan out of it. And then they just optically transport whatever it is back to the, you know, back to the, you know, the point where they've got their layer three, and the customer doesn't know any different. Like, they're not going to see any performance degradation because it's literally just fiber, right? It's just where that layer three route point or the layer two convergence happens is just a different location. So there are definitely, you know, there's precedent for these models that are sort of outside of what we think is normal. And you know, it's just a question of what you can support and what you can afford and what is your, you know, what are you trying to accomplish?
Well, and here's the other thing that I would say, that this is a theme that I keep hammering, because a lot of times we have these conversations, you know, like we're in the pre-pandemic state, and, you know, like it or not, you look at the world we live in now with supply chain problems and chip shortages and all that. It's not just what do I want to do? It's what can I get? And it's not like this is a problem that's going to solve itself overnight. Like we're, you know, we got like 1 to 2 year timelines for all these different things. And so the way I look at it when we're working with ISPs is, you know, let's look at what we can do. Cause if you know, you're not going to say no, if somebody wants to light up a service or a territory with, you know, this particular service that I want to sell for a provider, you know, I'm not going to say no, cause oh, I got to wait till I get my, you know, my perfect chassis or my perfect box that fits in my design. You know, whether that's at the network layer, whether that's at the optical layer, you know, you're going to go put out what you can get. And so I feel like, you know, we're entering a new world of I've got to be a little more flexible. And I think I think this is easier for last mile providers because they've been used to consuming large, you know, a variety of different vendors for a long time, not so much by choice, but just because that's the way it is when you hang radios and ONTs and OLTs and all these different things out, you have 20 or 30 or 40 vendors. If you talk to other providers, they're going to be like, oh, no, I've got to, you know, maintain these, you know, two or three providers so I can keep things lean. And I feel like that model is going to get severely tested and challenged in the next, you know, year to two, because you're not going to say no to the business unit when they want to deliver a service to meet your ideal network design model. So I think we're entering new territory here from that perspective. And I bring that up because disaggregated is often used as commodity hardware, you know, white box switches, you know, ODMs, like, you know, we talk about EdgeCore and Delta and Eufy Space, and there's a whole bunch of them out there, and that supply chain has fared a lot better. So we, you know, one of the things we see is people are diving into that faster than ever before, which lends itself well to the idea of the disaggregated chassis because it's available and people can get it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, that's definitely a big theme that we saw was, you know, talking about disaggregation at all layers. Yeah, not only just the operating systems from the hardware, but also just, you know, disaggregating your services from the underlay, you know, by having better overlay protocols like, you know, EVPN and all the various EVPN stuff that we talked about. I did think it was interesting, and we'll put a plug for the basically for the on-premise roundtable that we recorded as part of, you know, being delegates. We recorded this and we'll put a link to it, but we talked a lot about this premise of what is the state of disaggregation these days? Is it dead? Is it alive? You know, I think, you know, interesting talk. I think folks should definitely go take a listen to that as well.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we're coming up on almost an hour at this point, and we haven't even talked about SRV6. That's a whole podcast, I think. I think Vince had an idea.
We're going to leave SRV6 as a separate.
We'll have to. I mean, we can't even scratch the surface in less than 10 minutes.
Well, I'll just sum up everything you need to know about SRV6 right here. It's either the best thing on Earth or the worst thing on Earth, and the sky's falling.
Man, you aren't kidding. There's no in between on that one. I'm interested to see the as I dig more into SRV6, what the camps are, the for camp and the against camp, because there doesn't seem to be
any in between. But I think, you know, a brief synopsis other than what Chris said is that there's been a lot of work that's happened on SRV6, and I think it's probably much closer to, well, there are people using it production and stuff now. So we don't know who any of them are because no one will say, but apparently they're large. And you know, I think it bears a little bit more time than we can give it today. Cause it's a really, really compelling. I sit in the camp of it's probably going to be the best thing.
I would agree. I think most of the arguments, you know, that I've heard against it, which we can get into there, don't seem to be centered around where carriers are intending to use it. They seem to be centered around it's almost like a straw man in a sense that and what I've seen is, hey, if you do this, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be bad. And then you look at what they're saying you should do, and nobody's proposing to use it in that way. So I'm looking forward to getting into SRV6 because I think, you know, Vince and I we're big on SRMPLS. Mm-hmm. We do lots of SRMPLS now, and these are a lot of people that are coming out of the LDP world. So Now that they've gotten comfortable with using ISIS and, you know, an SRMPLS and things like that, looking towards SRv6 is probably a little bit easier because it's still in the segment routing family. But I think we should totally, we need a 3-hour special, Nick, on that
three,
one.
A 3-hour tour.
3-hour holiday special. Yeah.
3-hour holiday tour of all of the SRs. Right. SRv6, SRm6, SRv6 Plus, SRmPLS. Oh, man. SRISIS, SROSPF. Oh, man.
I think so. I've done, just to sort of put a bow on it, I've done some labbing with SRv6 on a couple of different platforms. It's more simple. But I've been in the V6 world for a very long time, so I probably take for granted the fact that I already understand all of the fundamentals of V6, or at least, you know, enough to be dangerous. But it's easy to go. If folks are interested in looking at it, probably the easiest way to go poke at it is to download FreeRouter. And I think I may even have a GitHub repo that has some of the SRv6 configs in it. So it's really easy to get started with that because it, you know, FreeRouter is a software-based router, has support for every protocol under the sun, and it does SRv6, and you can run it in Eve or whatever you want.
Doesn't free range routing do SRv6 now as well?
I haven't, or no? It might. I haven't actually tried it on that yet, but we have ZTVI. We turn true. It on.
Yeah, if it does, I think we should get El Donato on here, Donald, and talk about maybe some of the actual guts of how it works on an implementation. That would be interesting.
That's a good call.
Even not, maybe just talking about what would it take to add it, and what's the interest, and what's the roadmap look like, if nothing else.
Yeah, that's a good call. If folks are interested in that, hit us up on Twitter or whatever. And speaking of that, we should probably wrap it up. We're coming up on an hour. Go around the room and tell everybody, first of all, what your stance is on SRv6. Are you in the love it or hate it camp? Where people can find you once again, and anything else you want to say. Let's start with Vince.
I'm in the, I think SRv6 is going to be great camp. And you can find me on Twitter at Shuli22 or blogging at stubarea51.net.
Kevin?
Yeah, I'm going to also agree with Vince, and I'm going to go into the SRv6 is great camp because I'm a practical network engineer. And I think if somebody tells me what's the best way to get to Europe in under 12 hours, I'm going to say fly on an airplane. And if they don't like that answer, I'd say, what's my other option? Because it's just like, what am I going to use as an underlay with IPv6? So that's the way I look at it. I think it's going to be great, and we'll address whatever the concerns are through, you know, the implementation. You can find me on at stubarea51 on Twitter, stubarea51.net for the blog, and my company page, iparchitects.com, which is iparchitects.com.
Awesome. And Chris?
All right, I'm Chris Gullings, and you can find me at CrankyNetMan on Twitter. You can find my blog, like I said, /64.tech. That's an IPv6 thing if you didn't get that. You can also find me, of course, on modem.show, at modemcast on the Twitters. And as far as my stance on SRv6, my hot take is it killed my mom, and I really hate it for that. But actually, my real stance is I need to play with it more. I don't know, but I do think it's a promising technology, and I think that it's a tool in the basket.
All right. Well, I am Nick Braulio. I'm at Forwarding Plane on the Twitter and blogging at forwardingplane.net and on modem.show. At modemcast, as Chris said, is our Twitter. I'm in the camp of, I think SRv6 has got some serious legs. I think SRmPLS had to come first just because it had to come first. But I think that, you know, SRv6 has got serious potential. So I'm gonna say I probably am in the like it camp. And with that, thanks a lot.
Thank you for tuning into the Modem Podcast, where yesterday's modems are today's transponders. For more information or to request a topic, please visit modem.show.